Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View, a podcast of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. It, of course, is a podcast where myself, Adam Lowther, Jim Petrosky, and Curtis McGiffin, the all-knowing, all-caring, all-seeing trio of grand poobahs, like to come together to discuss important topics of the day, mostly related to nuclear issues, China, Russia, the Ukraine conflict, stuff like that. But today we're going to deviate a little bit. We're bringing in Gerald Goodfellow to join the discussion. And for those of you that already know Gerald, you know Krusty. But for those of you that don't, Gerald is a retired Air Force General Officer who is now the CEO of the Small Business Consulting Corporation, which he started after retiring to bring capabilities to Air Force Global Strike Command. And one of the reasons that we asked Gerald, of course, he's one of the main benefactors of NIDS, but we also asked him to come on the show to discuss this effort, because for many who know contracting in the military and the Air Force and the federal government writ large, it can be a very difficult thing. It's hard for agencies and the military to get the capabilities that they need, and much less to do it quickly and effectively. And so this is sort of what Gerald is really good at and what SBCC is working on. And so for those of you out there who might have your own companies who are thinking to yourselves, man, I would really like to take my product and see if the Air Force or the Army or somebody else might need it, or the National Labs, maybe that's another place. How do I do that? What can I do? What is some advice? And so we thought we'd bring Gerald on and just sort of have a discussion about this contracting problem. Now, Gerald, let me throw, a few years ago, I did a big study on reforming the acquisition system. And what we did is we went to go start studying it, and we found that in the last 10 years, there had been over 150 acquisition reform studies already conducted. So the reality is we already know everything that's wrong with acquisition, and we already know how to fix it. But yet, we're not even close to having an efficient and effective acquisition system. So as you are trying to get these capabilities to the Air Force, what is it you see in your experience, and sort of how do you look at this problem and finding a solution for it?
Adam, it's a really good question. You talk about needing acquisition reform in the military. And, I couldn't agree more. I think that both acquisition and contracting in our Air Force as a whole, there's some really good examples of people who are doing acquisition out there, individual people who are tremendous that really do believe, we need to make things better. They have an appropriate view of risk, and things by those people get done. I think as a whole, though, that the both acquisition and contracting, in my mind, are the two biggest things that really do probably need to be reformed in our military. Just so they can move at the speed of. At the same kind of speed that our enemies are moving with regard to being able to acquire things. And I assume, put them on contract, with companies. We have a nation that I think the number one thing we do in our nation is we're in terms of, bringing, capability that could be important to the military is we are a highly innovative nation. So, we start, I bet you thousands of companies, a day in this country, right, that are bringing, and many of those companies are bringing capabilities that could make the military, more lethal, more capable of defending our nation. Yet when those companies come try to work with the military, the first thing they run into is your Air Force contracting. And even if they have the best idea in the world, you know, I always use this as an example because I'm here in Global Strike Command, and they fly the B-52, for instance. It's this big kind of burly bomber, neat airplane, built it back in the 1950s and 60s. We're still flying a pretty incredible airplane, but it's a great big airplane, and you can see it from hundreds of miles away on a radar, right? And I always said if somebody came up with some paint or some spray where we could spray it on the B-52 and make it completely invisible, to the naked eye, people in it would be invisible. I'm of course dreaming, and it would be invisible to radar. Nobody would see it coming, right? If it'd be a pretty cool invention, right? But I'm saying if we did that and we said, okay, now let's get this capability, let's say whatever it costs probably didn't matter, but now we want to get this capability onto what people call a program of record. I'm betting in the best of scenarios, it would take us 3 to 5 years to get that capability long-term funding in our military, right? It would take many months if we needed to buy that stuff in mass to even get it on contract before it became a program of record, if you could find the money to do it, right? Well, we see capabilities all the time that the military would make the military better, new capabilities. But to get those things on contract, for one, which is usually the starting point, does not happen quickly, and then let alone once they're on contract and they perform and we really like them, to actually get them, long-term money, what I call the DOD cliff of death, which is getting, if you get across the DOD, what I call, it's worse than the valley of death, because it I always say you got to get across the DOD cliff of death to really make it in government, which is, kind of the bridge across way, to long-term money. If you don't get long-term money, I always tell people you're just playing a game of acquisition, or innovation theater, whatever you want to call it, because we're never going to use your stuff, at scale unless it's got long-term money. And in my mind, the second hardest thing you'll ever do in the military is take a new capability, no matter how good it is, and get it long-term money. Make it a program. People will say, make it a program of record. Sometimes maybe you're doing that. Maybe, you're getting some support money for it long-term. Maybe you're adding it to another program. Say in my B-52 example, you're probably just adding it to the B-52 program. Those things take a tremendous amount of time. And quite frankly, it takes so long that most of it is never even looked at as an option for making things better, because, when we do the POM cycle, this vicious cycle that happens every 2 years, we're not looking for something that may be ready in 3 years, kind of thing. So it's really, it's a real nuisance. And if we don't get the acquisition reform, I'm convinced that we will become, we will become a near peer competitor to China, if we're not already there, quite frankly. And, I'll tell you what, I don't want to live in a world where America is the near peer to China. If we're not there, we're desperately close, and it's a much uglier world. So those are kind of my opening thoughts, Adam.
Now, I've wondered why, we created the Defense Innovation Unit, and we created AFWERX and StrikeWERX and all of these entities that are supposed to do exactly what you're talking about. But is that not working, or is, and I know Jim evaluates a lot of new capabilities. And so what then is the problem? Why are we not these, we've recognized our problem. We've essentially tried to come up with a solution, but yet somehow it doesn't seem to be working.
I'm not sure we've ever fully, come up with a comprehensive solution. So, I was very involved in the very beginnings of AFWERX, for instance, three of the people that are the primary founders were working with me on technology accelerators at the time. And, I was able to help them, eventually get approval to get AFWERX going, all that kind of stuff. And quite frankly, I think AFWERX has been a phenomenal organization for our Air Force, along with DIU. I'm always interested that we put you know, some really strong civilian leaders in charge of places like DIU, and they end up leaving, right? You know, because they feel like, hey, they really can't get the things done that need to be done. But I'll tell you, I have great respect for both of those organizations, but much more familiar with AFWERCS than I am DIU. And so I'll talk about AFWERCS, this organization that has a, you know, that I probably couldn't be more proud of the Air Force, you know, going down that path when they did. And always when we were originally talking about it, we talked about how are we going to transition capabilities to long-term money. And AFWERCS, you know, I think, you know, that's where they kind of started. And I think they would still, they still love the idea of doing that. And there are some things that come out of, you know, the, say, AFWERCS, you know, that we're are discovering AFWERCS and the multitude of things they do that do have got some long-term money. But even there, I think it's a rarity. I think, and I don't think AFWERCS is the organization, I don't think, that is largely the organization that's going to take something into long-term fund. What they're really good at is doing like, you know, awarding small business innovative research contracts to companies that have capabilities and bringing them in and, you know, and using R&D money, you know, which I always call the easiest money you'll ever have in the Air Force. All money in the Air Force is kind of hard, but R&D money, you know, you can do things. You can bring in new capabilities. You can look at how they'll affect the service. But it's going to run out at some point. You're only going to get maybe 3 to 5 years if you're lucky of R&D money, and then you need program money. And I think AFWERCS is an organization that largely focuses on the early R&D money, and they're quite frankly pretty good at it. I think, you know, in the early days, I think they wanted to be pretty good at transition too. And it just never went there, right? It was, you know, there's other organizations, I think, that, you know, really have that as something they should be doing. And it never really got a lot of traction in AFWERCS. So the thing they do really well is this early stuff. But moving that early stuff into actual long-term capabilities, you know, although I think AFWERCS would like to do that, I don't think they're the organization that largely does. They're certainly not doing that at any kind of scale. What they are doing pretty good at scale is bringing in those initial new capabilities. And, you know, I think there's other organizations, the MAGCOMs, I know, right now, at least, I know there's a move afoot to create the ICC and, you know, that could change some things. But right now, as we speak, you know, it's the MAGCOMs and the program offices that are largely responsible for doing requirements and bringing in long-term capabilities. And from what I've seen, it just doesn't happen. It does not happen fast at any kind of scale that's meaningful is what it comes down to.
Jim, you wanted to jump in here.
Yeah. And first of all, for the audience, I have a great friendship with Gerald Goodfellow and I really have a lot of respect for the work that he's doing, but he's also my mentor in running an organization and taught me a lot about doing this. And you need someone like that, but also someone who is a magnet or a magnate maybe for people to come to them that have the background knowledge and build off of that. And so I've been impressed with that and learned a lot from that. And so I want to turn this sort of on its head. We've talked about the Air Force, Gerald, but you know, I always think of innovation comes from taking risk, reducing overhead, and then turning people free. And your organization sort of done that very well. And maybe you can talk about the SBC side of this and how your organization is functioning to do this sort of, I call it dating contract, whatever you want to call it, you know, this method of bringing in the innovators to know what needs to be done in the mission and then getting that onto the ground so we can get it to the warfighter as fast as possible. Can you tell us a little bit about how that functions with this at SBCC and some of the programs that you have?
Yeah, I will tell you, you know, we do a number of things in SBCC, but the thing you're talking about, Jim, and it is really the thing that, you know, is what I would consider the foundation, the core of the company. And I think what we do really well, and it's not just with Global Strike Command, we're helping a number of other organizations, although I'm very, you know, I've spent a lot of time in Global Strike Command. I'm very proud of what they're doing to try to move this all forward. But, you know, we're also doing stuff with AMC, you know, and AETC, you know, looking for small opportunities in ACC now. And then I'll say that we got the four primary organized training equip commands, you know, I'm going. But here's what we try to do. So the first thing we do is, you know, we try to understand where the problems are. But let me kind of talk to let me talk down to this as if it's one problem. So we would seek to understand the problem. What is it that global, you know, let's say it's Global Strike Command, for instance, or anywhere in the Air Force, and they have a problem. And let's say that problem is that they don't have, you know, adequate satellite communication capability, you know, 100% of the time when their airplanes are out there flying, or they don't have, you know, the ability to communicate 100% of the time, whether it's satellite or any kind of other communication. And, you know, we would quite frankly like to talk to our bombers, and, you know, 100% of the time, especially, you know, if they happen to be on a, you know, carry nuclear weapons, for instance, we really might want to have really good communication with them. And let's just say that we're not 100% confident that we'll have that all the time. And so, you know, that would be understanding the problem. Okay, we would like to be able to talk to our bombers 100% of the time. You know, if crews are in the air, we want to be able to talk to them. And then we would say, we probably ask a lot of why questions, you know, a lot of what is the current capability? When do we really have, you know, times when they can't talk? You know, we had really seek to understand the problem deeply. Let's just say that after we looked at this, we found that there was real times where we don't have appropriate communications with, you know, say the command element that we would want. Well, we would say, okay, let's see if we can identify some solutions. And let's just say that we found a satellite communication capability that we thought would really survive, say, a nuclear war or nuclear exchanges. It would still be up and running. And we want to use that, you know, we decide we want to use that satellite communication capability, and it doesn't happen to be in our airplanes right now. We'd say, okay, what kind of companies can provide that? Is there a company out there? Is there multiple companies out there that can provide it? And if they do, you know, we tech scout that company, you know, and we will talk to that company, you know, we'll get to know them and their capabilities, and then, you know, we'll take that information on a contract we have with Global Strike Command. We'll take it back to Global Strike Command and say, hey, you know, we think there is a commercial solution out here. We're always looking for the commercial solution, the solution that exists. So we're not starting at the very beginning. We're saying, okay, there's a problem. Is there a commercial solution? If there isn't a commercial solution, I largely say that my company doesn't get involved. We are looking for true commercial solutions that exist. If it does exist, you know, we try to, as you called it, Jim, we try to marry up the government and this company to you know, get into bed together, for lack of a better way to describe it, where that company can actually bring that capability, you know, to the Air Force. And so at that point, let's say we find a company that has never worked with the Air Force before. They've never had a government contract. We would get involved, and we would mentor and coach them through those kinds of things to help, you know, to try to make it easier for them to actually start working, you know, with the government. And you know, Global Strike Command would, or we never charge the company. You know, we're trying to bring capability to the military, so the military, you know, kind of pays us to, you know, understand the problem, you know, identify the solutions, you know, tech scout and those kinds of things. And let's say we now get them on a contract. We would then say, okay, can we build a plan? And, you know, it's interesting enough, you'd always think that the military is good at planning. I've come to find out they're not that great at it, but we would help them build a plan once we thought this was going to be a long-term capability that we needed, we would build what we call the transition plan. How are we going to and we don't, you know, quite frankly, you know, if our knowledge of the systems helps us to do things faster, we'll take it. But largely we just say, look, for right now, we're living in the system we're living in. How do you get this company to long-term money? Does that mean, you know, that we're We're working POM submissions for them, you know, to get them, you know, program objective memorandum decisions. It's how we, you know, get stuff into, you know, into funding consideration. But we basically build a plan to try to get them long-term resources once it's determined that this is something that we want in our capability. And we follow them all the way through as they're executing. We try to get them to the long-term money. Not unlike the Air Force does when they're running a program. They're doing exactly the same thing. What we're doing that's a little bit different, you know, I would say from the way, you know, others do similar things. But what we're doing is we're trying to start with something that's usually like a company that's like, you know, it's like at least a mid-stage company. You know, most of the companies we work with have been in business for a number of years. We have one company we work with that's a late-stage company. One of the few late-stage companies, but one of the most innovative companies we work with has been in business for 43 years. And until they started doing something interesting enough with their satellite communication capability, they had never had a government contract, although they were flying their capability on like over 500 helicopters and airplanes doing medical rescue stuff. Turns out that the thing they had was better than the stuff that the Air Force is flying on its airplanes. So, you know, so we would then get them into this system that largely for companies that don't understand it, most would argue it's impossible for them to navigate. This guy was talking about, you know, he does several hundred million dollars a year in revenue in both, you know, helicopter rescue that he does. And, you know, like he fixes helicopters and been in business for 43 years. One of the, you know, been a great mentor of mine since I got into business. And, you know, we started helping him with some Global Strike Command stuff. You know, he'll tell you, you know, a guy who does hundreds of millions of dollars worth a year in the corporate sector, you know, where they really do force people to be good. He'll tell you that, you know, he'll tell you the toughest thing he's ever done in his 43 years of business is work contracting with the Air Force. You know, he is no kidding. He's a patriot, right? This guy I'm talking about, he'd give it to the Air Force for free if he could, you know, and he can actually, that's not allowed, but he is a guy that he's been in business for 43 years. He's in his 70s. And to him, this is the most meaningful thing he could possibly do at this point in his life is help make America more secure. Was surprised that he had a capability that the Air Force found very valuable, right? Yet, you know, it is telling when a guy like that who's been highly successful out there will tell you the most frustrating thing he's done, the hardest thing he's done in 43 years is actually, you know, work with the government. You know, we should not accept that as an answer, I don't think.
So as you think about the challenges that, you know, Global Strike Command in particular is facing, and you think about the needs, if you had sort of you could do anything, what capabilities would you want to try to provide or get companies that can provide to Air Force Global Strike Command? Where is the command and the nuclear force really in need of these kind of specific niche capabilities? What are they?
Well, I think there's a lot of capabilities, you know, Adam, we have to be able to communicate. And you would think in today's day and age where we've been through actually more than a couple of communication revolutions over the last couple of decades, you know, true communication revolutions. And to realize, I mean, I realized at some point that we don't have, you know, assured communications like when some of our airplanes are in the air, for instance. You know, that's bothersome. One of the first things I'd start with is making sure we can communicate with the people we need to communicate with. You know, that would be certainly one capability. I will tell you, I would have the most robust. Now, and oh, by the way, does a commercial organization have a role in nuclear capabilities? I'm going to argue yes. You know, I look at like our Sentinel system right now, And I remember when I was a 5-8 at Global Strike Command, we thought that this thing would be, you know, in the mid-90s, $90 billion price range. And now, you know, I'm reading in the paper, it's more like in the $150 billion price range. You know, how do we get a 60%? It's probably more than that to tell you the truth. How do we get 60% increases in this? Is this, you know, a lot of people just say, oh, the prime's trying to screw the government. I actually don't know if that's the real reason or not. But I do think that there's a problem when we lit a contract and within a couple of years, you know, like one of the biggest contracts, you know, we've ever had in the government, you know, $100 billion, right, to basically recapitalize our ICBMs, right? And within a couple of years, you know, we have a Nunn-McCurdy breach, which, you know, this was supposed to, Nunn-McCurdy is supposed to be really hard to get to. It's supposed to be like a 10% overage in what we thought it was going to be. And, you know, it's always a big deal. They usually go all the way up to like SecDef when you have a Nunn-McCurdy breach. And so when we have like a 60% Nunn-McCurdy breach, you know, I think to myself, oh my goodness, what are we, how, who's going to get fired over this thing? You know, how did this happen? And the true answer is, I don't think anybody's going to get fired over it, you know? But we should ask, you know, I always say, who's going to be held accountable here? You know, and who's in charge of this, right? You know, Americans should know, but, you know, if you're trying to recapitalize your ICBM system, and it's that kind of money, people will start asking, is this an affordable thing? Can I just nurse Minuteman III, for another 20 years? You know, can I take risks in Minuteman III? You know, like not do test launches and all kinds of things. There's other solutions rather than spending, an extra $100 billion on something, right? I hate that I think that way, because I would just like, I would like a military, you know, I would like, you know, the military in industry that produces military capabilities, I'd like them to be highly efficient regardless of what they're doing. So, you know, I do wonder, you know, I mean, why do we issue a contract? I would love for our contracting and acquisition system just to be better at them. Because I've wondered on this, and I was a part of this, you know, I was probably, you know, I could take some blame and how that all in all, when I was on active duty, how that all turned out. But I do wonder, you know, why we wish issue a single contract to a single contractor to do everything when so much of, say, Minuteman III is actually building things, you know, like, you know, digging holes and, you know, pouring lots of concrete underground. And, you know, we have some tremendous construction companies in this country. So why do I decide that I want like a defense contractor to do all that work, you know? And I still don't know the answer. Is it because we don't have enough of the contracting to do the integration work? You know, is it it seems to me not to make any sense. I just like things to make sense. I don't know if I answered your question. You were, you know, getting back to your original question, you're saying, hey, what kinds of things, you know, do you think we need? Well, I guess I would start out, I don't think there's anything more important than our nuclear deterrence. So if we don't think the one we currently have is adequate and we'd like to build a new one, I would like to bring in capabilities for that nuclear deterrent that can be delivered on time, on budget, on capability. And, I asked a question at a thing that you and Curtis and, well, actually you and Jim were, I don't think Curtis was there, but it was a thing we went, it was a nuclear symposium we went to. And I asked the guy, you know, in charge of it, what, you know, when I was the 5-8 at Global Strike Command, we used to say we needed to start putting the first missiles in the ground. You know, the very first ones somewhere in the neighborhood of around 2028, I seem to remember. And now I'm hearing that those missiles may not go into the ground until the 2040s. That unclassified, obviously, because that was told to me. I don't have any access to the true classified numbers, but that was told in an unclassified setting to me by a general to a whole group of people by a general who should know. I think we should consider it unacceptable that we're not going to be able to replace our missile systems within the next, you know, within the next 15 years. To get the first Minuteman III squadron the first Minuteman squadron back, we started in like 1959 with a design. It was 3 years and 8 months from the time the design contract was lit to the time that we had like an entire ICBM squadron on alert, right? 3 years and 8 months. I just want the capability we want in a reasonable time. I'll tell you, I want three things. I want it on time. I want it on budget. I want to enter into contracts that don't double in cost or triple or 10 times in cost. I'd like it on time. I'd like it on budget. And I'd like when we write a contract that it actually is delivered on time, on budget, and we get the actual capability we paid for. And I think not to overstate this, but I think it's more of a rarity than the rule that actually happens in our current system.
Yeah,
something's got to be fixed. If those things aren't happening on time, on budget, on capability, as the rule rather than the exception, we've got a problem.
Well, Krusty, one of the things that we pride ourselves here at the NIDS View is being one of the best drive time podcasts. We try not to be any more than 30 minutes so that for those people who have a 30 minute commute, we're that perfect length in time. So we're right at our 30 minute window. Now, I will say for those who are listening and not watching on YouTube, Curtis has been doing a great job of active listening throughout this whole thing. He hadn't said anything this episode, but if you saw him on YouTube, he's doing a great job active listening. So Curtis has done his part today. So I appreciate you doing that, Curtis. Now, of course, we are out of time. And Gerald.
You've had even a couple of extra minutes of time. You should let Adam, or maybe it's not this podcast, but you should let Curtis at some point tell the NIDS story, because it was largely his brainchild in the beginning, and now you have this unbelievable think tank organization, and you guys concentrate pretty much solely on nuclear deterrence, and I think you're the only think tank that I know of in America who does that. So maybe sometime, Curtis, if you ever do that on a future podcast, make sure I get to hear it.
Well, let me just say this: I don't want to leave deprive the listeners of my voice. So let me just say this for a moment. So Gerald, it's been what you've done for this organization in your support and helping us to stand this organization up and then execute now over 2 years. It's just phenomenal. You've not only grown your fantastic SBCC organization, but what you've done in this organization to further this cause. It's almost like a twofer. You are a twofer when it comes to supporting national security and the mission of deterrence, because you're doing it both in the industry side and you're doing it through your support here at NIDS. I'd like to throw one quick thought out. I don't need a comment. I'm not even going to ask a question. I just want to add to your statement, Gerald, that we always talk here at NIDS about credibility and what that means to deterrence. And we're always thinking about credibility and the ability when it comes from our ability to posture, our ability to project forces, and all of the things that kind of go with that. We rarely talk about how credibility is born or lost by our success rate at R&D and acquisition, and whether or not if we're a nation that wants to play continue to play, we have to be able to develop, test, and then evaluate, and then purchase, and then field these systems, as you said, on budget, on time, and meeting the capability requirements that were outlined. The part of the problem is it takes so damn long to do this that by the time we produce this equipment, it's already needing to be upgraded. In the 50s, a fighter jet of the Sentry series would go from literally from blueprint to squadron in 2.5-3 years. We can't even get through the validation process or the EPA studies in that time frame. And what this does is it's such an albatross. It affects our ability to maintain credibility with our adversaries and our allies. We simply cannot build the stuff anymore. As I mentioned in a previous podcast, we are 15 years into a 30-year modernization process, and we have no new iron on the flight line and no new steel in a silo. And I'm not sure how we continue to say that we are a preeminent threat to the world with a system that we just continue to limp along, and we don't make changes that aren't going to do the things that we need to do so that we have the capacity to instill some sort of sense of fear on the adversary so that we will, in fact, successfully deter them. We cannot continue to deter with the jalopy. We need the new stuff. And we need it to work, and it can't break the bank.
You know, Curtis, I will tell you, you already heard me say, I love the B-52. I mean, what a great engineered airplane, you know, that was built in the late 50s, early 60s. You know, you'll hear people brag that we're going to fly that airplane until it's 100 years old. And I always tell people we should be ashamed of ourselves.
That's right.
You know, we used to build airplanes, entire new fleets of airplanes every 6 to 7 years. We did that for like 30 years. And now, you know, a new fighter jet will take us, you know, 37 years. You know, I actually believe it's a crisis, and it's largely unrecognized.
We just keep,
you know, hopping along. But we will be challenged in this country. I always say, thank goodness when things are kind of as bad as they are in terms of, you know, bringing new capabilities. Well, thank goodness we can still count on our nuclear deterrent.
That's right.
It may end up being the only thing we really can count on. And even that, as we try to upgrade it, you know, it's going to turn into decades and decades, right? To get that to where it needs to be. We shouldn't accept that as a country. We're the United States of America, you know, and we should be able to do better than that.
That's
and
right.
The fact is that we've created a system for whatever reason, however it's happened, we should acknowledge, you know, where we are today. We should be realists about this. What exists today? And if the answer is we can't replace our missile systems in less than 15 to 20 years, we can't create new fighters in less than 30 years. You know, if this is really where we are, we should acknowledge that and say we're not going to accept it anymore. We're going to move fast, and that means probably a whole bunch of stuff needs to change. And most things boil down to leadership, and we need leadership on these issues.
That's
and
right.
I'll tell you mentioned risk. I will also tell you that we need leaders with an appropriate view of risk.
Right.
And all too often, I'm not going to point to any service or any, you know, rank, because you get leaderships at all levels. But I think it's become, we have a culture where most people out there at all ranks don't seem to have an appropriate view of risk. And they're kind of unwilling to take any of it, right? And so unless it's perfect, we don't build it. It just adds time to everything we do. You know, we should accept some failure in this in what we do. And largely, we become a country that doesn't seem to accept any. And we kill people that have failure. You know, we have to change the way we do things, or we will lose to the Chinese. We are going to become a second rate power. Sorry, Adam, we went way over, but you know, I think all day long.
This is what the DC area needs to hear. So thank you very much, Gerald. Thank you for what you do, and thank you for being here today.
Yeah, thank you guys. Thanks,
Adam.
Thanks.
Close us out.
Well, fortunately, to solve this problem, Gerald, the Air Force is in the midst of a reorganization, which will certainly solve that problem. And I'm sure things will get better here very soon. And as Secretary Kendall has said, he plans to stay into the next administration and to see to it that the reorganization is completed. So I'm sure your problems will be solved here very soon. So, of course, we want to thank Gerald for joining us. Jim, Curtis, always good to see you guys. And of course, we want to thank you, the listeners, because without you listening, it would just be four dudes talking to themselves. And so thanks for being there. And of course, as always, hit us up, you know, hit the website up. If there's, you know, there's articles, there's global security review, there's other podcasts, there's the HUSI events. If you want to scroll through the list of HUSI events and find one that's interesting, and you know, they're all 1 hour long, and you've got an hour and a topic you're interested in, you know, watch a HUSI event, or you can listen to old podcasts, or you can read Curtis and I's dynamic parity report. There's all kinds of stuff. You know, it's a cornucopia of nuclear stuff at thingdeterrence.com. So check it out. Check out Curtis, as always, on the Twitter, and see what he's got to say and what articles he thinks are interesting at Think Deterrence. I think that's what it's called.
At Think Deterrence.
At Think Deterrence on the Twitter or on the X. And, of course, as always, we want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.